This is Helen Gurley Brown, and I think offices are the sexiest places on Earth.
And this is Joe Pine. I don't even know what I'm doing here, but the action starts in just a moment. And our guest is Helen Gurley Brown. Helen is the author of the two best-selling and rather, to put it mildly, controversial books, Sex and the Single Girl, and her new provocative tome, Sex and the Office Girl. And she is known for her outspokenness and liberal views with respect to the single women of America. Is that a pretty good description of you, Helen Gurley Brown?
That sounds quite fair, Joe. Yes,
actually,
it is.
We said Sex and the Office Girl. It's Sex in the Office. It's not The Office Girl, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sex in the Office.
But is that a pretty good description of you?
Yeah, I'm kind of outspoken and controversial.
But it doesn't tell anything about the larceny that's in your heart, does it?
I won't deny there's some larceny in my heart. I don't know what your definition of larceny is, but...
Well, it usually has to do with people who steal things, right?
I don't steal anything.
You admit in your own book that you're a thief.
Oh, Joe, you've started already. I thought maybe we could just be pleasant for a minute or two, but you're talking about the expense chapter, aren't you? Office expenses.
Well, I'm talking about the time you stole the towels from the hotels and how you advise people to steal things such as pens and that kind of thing. And you even tell people in here how to steal from their bosses and how to pad the expense account.
Well, I have to plead guilty to all those things. However, I said I was a reformed thief as far as hotel property was concerned, and I really felt pretty shabby about the towels that I'd taken over a period of about 15 years. For one thing, they just get raveled and frayed looking, and it isn't any permanent kind of a possession anyway. And when you look at them years later, you think, for this I sold out, you know, for a bunch of dilapidated towels. So I simply suggested that if a girl were going to take something from a hotel room, if she felt constrained to do this, that she would simply confine it to hotel stationery and maybe one of those 39-cent hotel pens. Now, so much for hotel stealing, and as far as office expenses are concerned, a company expects you to profit somewhat on your expense account. I think it's unrealistic to say
companies
that
you expect you to steal?
Right.
I never worked for such a company. I never received these instructions.
Oh, Joe, you know, I think you're a gifted man, but I do sometimes think you're hideously naive.
That's me all over. I go through life not stealing anything. I'm hideously naive. You know, they've got people up in the penitentiary that you would probably admire. They're not naive, but they're away.
No, I don't believe in stealing the kind of thing that puts you in the penitentiary. In offices, I don't believe in stealing large amounts of money or office furniture or hi-fi equipment or anything.
You don't agree with the idea that, in other words, you're not suggesting people steal large things, right?
No, I'm suggesting that they go along with the expense account
How about Chapter
rules
12, Helen?
That have been set down. And you just listen for a minute.
Yeah, but how about Chapter 12 where the title is How to Steal a Chippendale Breakfront?
Well, that's based on a little story of some girls I know who stole one from Music Corporation of America, and that was a pretty mean coup to get that out from under the nose of Jules Stein in broad daylight from that fancy building on Burton Way in Beverly Hills, and that's why I call the chapter that. The thing is that many companies pay their employees through an expense account. They don't pay them a salary as big as they might receive because they want the employee to have a good tax advantage, so they pay them through the expense account. And if you go down there putting down that you actually ate breakfast for 85 cents when the company is willing and able and eager for you to say that you spent $4.85 for breakfast, then you're a kind of ninny.
In other words, you are saying you're a ninny then if you don't steal not from your company, really, but from your government.
That's putting me in a pretty rough spot. I'm not concerned with the government. I'm only concerned with the structure of the company and the employees within that company. And I know there is right and wrong and good and bad and stealing and not stealing, but making out an expense account in an orderly, intelligent fashion, I don't consider stealing. It's just part of the structure of American business these days.
You see, we're talking about this one point, which is relatively minor point in your book. We haven't even gotten to sex yet. I can only say, Helen, that you look most demure to have written a handbook on sin.
Well, that's one of the most complimentary things you've said to me yet. I'm glad to hear Sex in the Office called a handbook on sin. That'll probably sell about 100,000 copies.
But isn't it true? You not only teach people how to steal, you show your admiration for these so-called, I guess you consider them female Robin Hood types, who have stolen a Chippendale breakfront. You think it's clever the way, you know, you probably would have voted for president somebody who was in the Lavender Hill mob. You admire people who get away with things. So there's one kind of sin. Your only commandment, you don't even pay attention to the Ten Commandments in this book. It's the 11th commandment that concerns Helen Gurley Brown. Thou shalt not get caught.
I sometimes think maybe you never worked in an office because, you see, in the business world, the idea is for the employee to get everything he can and for the employer to get everything he can. You're kind of locked in a lovely death grip together.
It's not an office. That's a jungle.
Sure, it's a jungle. It's often been called a jungle.
But we're not animals.
Of course we're animals. What do you think we are if we aren't animals?
Well, I don't know what kind of a crowd you run around with, Helen, but the people I know are humans.
But humans are animals. If you want to be technical about it, you're either a mineral, a vegetable, or an animal, and I'm an animal.
Well, I guess that makes me a vegetable, huh? Well, let's look at some of the chapters in this handbook on sin called Sex in the Office by Helen Gurley Brown. Now, chapter number one, How to Love a Boss. What do you mean by that?
I think a girl should do just that. She should love her boss. On certain days of the week, she's the only person in the whole world who does. He's not getting along too well at home. He's been clobbered in a meeting. He comes back to his secretary to have his wounds bound up, and she should be loving, compassionate, tender, and concerned about him at all times. I'm not much for the geisha girl concept of women-pleasing men. Ordinarily, I'm for women-pleasing men and men-pleasing women. But in the secretary-boss relationship, she should be loving and pleasing at all times until she moves out of that category into another job. I think bosses make lousy lovers. I don't think a secretary should fall in love with her boss because
why
that's
do you think bosses make lousy lovers, Helen? I always thought it was the Latins that made lousy lovers.
Well, by that I mean a boss isn't a good person for a girl to fall in love with because usually it means that she's going to have to leave the company sooner or later.
Oh,
one of them
you
has
weren't
to
talking
go.
About his proficiency at all.
Oh, no, I didn't mean technically that he wouldn't be any good. It's just that it's not a smart thing for a girl to do. She can fall in love with somebody else's boss, but hands off of her own.
Now, in your book, you talk about a girl being a lady most of the year in the office, but if she has been a lady most of the year, a couple of times a year she can wear what you call a joy dress. This apparently is to create some eroticism in the office for at least 24 hours. Would you mind telling us why a girl should have a joy dress and be a tramp one day or 2 days out of the year and a lady the rest of the time in the office?
Having a joy dress doesn't make her a tramp, you know. Having a joy dress just simply means that on that particular day, she can wear a dress that's cut rather low in front. I suggest that it be high when she's facing the office manager, and then when she leans over, it's kind of low when she's leaning over the man that she wants to impress. Or she can leave the next button of her shirt unbuttoned. If it's usually unbuttoned two buttons, it can be unbuttoned three buttons on this particular day. And that's just to stir up a little excitement. I think sexy girls are successful girls.
Is that your joy dress that you're wearing today?
No, not really. This is just a little, just a little black dress.
Uh-huh, a little black dress. what is that supposed to do? Is that just for autograph parties at bookstores or?
Well, the thing is that this is the kind of dress perhaps that I'm talking about because it's a sophisticated little black number and it looks very officey from certain angles, and from other angles it's kind of low in the neck, and I think every girl should have a couple of these in her wardrobe and wear them every so often to the office. You see, an office is not a place to be a little brown wren or a mouse. It's a place to be a very sexy, provocative, exciting girl. So clothes have something to do with that.
I always thought that offices were places to get some work done.
They are places to get some work done.
You have these swingers hanging from the chandeliers, running around with these wild dresses, affairs with bosses. He comes back from a meeting, and immediately she puts him on a couch and strokes his head with warm water or something. I don't know what kind of a place you think an office is, but apparently you've worked in offices, have you?
I worked in 19 of them. That's why I felt I was able to write a book about offices. And the fact is that a lot of work gets done in sexy offices because a sexy office is a happy office. And when employees are happy, the sales curve rises and profits soar. And just because the men and women have fun together doesn't mean that it isn't a very efficient organization.
It sounds very funsy and very gamesy. I don't know what kinds of offices you've worked in, but you yourself obviously must have been a swinger.
I consider myself to have been a swinger. However, people have different definitions of what swinging is.
Well, we'll come back and swing with Helen Gurley Brown after this word. What about your activities in the office? You've only been married about 5 years, so prior to that, you were a bachelor girl for a number of years. And did you, for example, make up to the boss, or did you pat his head when he came back from a tough meeting? Or
I was always very good to my bosses, as a matter of fact, and I think thereby I got onto the next rung of the ladder. But by being good to a boss, it doesn't mean that you even lay a hand on him physically. You're good to him in that you are for him, you believe in him, you support all his crazy schemes. Now, a wife sometimes has to have cold terror running through her when the man she's married to suggests that he's going to try something daring at the office, whereas a secretary doesn't really have anything to lose but her job, and she can always get another one, and she doesn't have any car payments or mortgage payments
due. She's a pretty irresponsible character, this prototype secretary of yours.
So she can be for the guy. Listen, back to that swinging definition, I believe in girls being swingers, but by that I just mean that they have a lot of fun. They get a great deal out of life, and they certainly should be getting all this from an office. A girl who goes to an office every day and is bored to tears and doesn't go to lunch with the men or have any fun at all, she should fire that office and get another job. That's what I keep telling her in my books. An office is a place to get rewards and results. It's a place to find men, and if the girl isn't finding them, she should do something about
it. Yeah, show me a girl who's having a lot of fun in an office, and I'll show you a girl from whom you're getting very little, if any, work.
Joe, that just simply isn't true. So there.
All right. Well, let's move along to your advice to some girls here. You've got a chapter here called Lunchland, the Matinee, where you actually instruct a young girl how to have an affair during the lunch hour with a married man in the office. You even give her recipes. How dare you, Helen Gurley Brown?
That particular chapter
was
written on, based on the story of a girl that I know. I just put down all her instructions for having this relationship at lunchtime because it is part of sex in the office. I found it rather unfeasible myself because this girl, for example, who has this lunchtime relationship can't ever wear perfume because the guy will go back to the office smelling like her Chanel No. 5 or Replique or Magritte or whatever she's wearing, and I would never want to have a relationship with any man with whom I couldn't wear my favorite fragrance. Also, they're not supposed to know each other in the office. They have to keep up this great facade of coolness, and they don't have dates any other time except at lunchtime if it's a correct and proper and basic, classic matinee relationship. I didn't dig it myself, but I felt it should be part of sex in the office because it is sexy and a lot of people do have this relationship.
Yeah, well, you're very careful about getting out of these things. You say that you couldn't give up wearing perfume for anybody, and you also add the reason why you wouldn't care for the matinee relationship is because you wouldn't like to be very cordial to a man who apparently never brings his own booze. You really researched
right.
This situation. How could you possibly know so much about it without having partaken of it?
A lot of people write things which they didn't participate in themselves. That's usually not true of me. In my books, I've usually done the things that I've talked about. This particular matinee relationship was not for me, however, because I don't believe in only seeing a man at lunchtime. Now, I'm not saying affairs are good or bad or trying to talk anybody into having them, but I do say if you're going to have one, I think it's rather dumb only to be able to conduct it over lunch.
I think you just contradicted yourself when you say you don't say affairs are good or bad. You have said in your book that an office affair can be one of the most rewarding relationships the two people could ever have. Right or wrong?
I did say that.
You did say that.
It does sound as though I've been contradictory.
You're trying to Mickey Mouse us here. Let's stick to the facts. You have here, for example, a menu that this girl is supposed to prepare for her inamorata during the matinee. Menu number one, which consists of clam chowder, cheese, brown bread, green salad, and coffee. You call it fishy fodder for a lover.
What's the matter with that?
I'm just reading here. Number two, you have a steak and so forth. You call that hearty luncheon for a tired warrior. And then menu number three is Mother's Cooking for a Deserving Lad, which consists of cold fried chicken and things of that nature. You have instructed this girl in conducting this matinee to be almost somebody conducting a symphony. She starts out making sure all the preparations are right, so that the action begins as he walks in the door. The menu is prepared, the fire is in the fireplace, the last curl is in place, and you also advise her the first couple of times that she can wear a very becoming dress, but after that, she can move on into the house dress category.
Not house dress.
Hostess,
lingerie.
Yeah.
Well, Joe, it's just that I think if a girl is going to be involved in a matinee relationship, she should do it in style, that's all.
Well, see, they're all through your book, and if somebody's going to steal, then steal the right way. And if somebody, you know, I expect that you're soon going to have a book on murder, and you're going to say, now, if you're going to murder somebody, which I don't recommend, but if you do murder somebody, pick somebody who really deserves it.
Oh, Joe Pine, you really can't equate murder with girls having affairs. I think you have a kind of puritanical, funny, rigid attitude about things.
I really don't, except that I never met anybody before who not only is in favor of sin, but writes a book of instructions for it.
Now, what are you calling sin? Having affairs? That's your opinion about whether
sin. Don't you think that it's a sin for a single girl to have an affair with a married man? First of all, it's a sin against society. Secondly, it's a sin against his wife. Thirdly, it's a sin against themselves because they're two people who are actually living a lie. What can come of it? An illegitimate child, possibly a disease, certainly a broken home, because these things always get back. The wife always finds out. You're married. What would you feel like if your husband pulled this shenanigan?
Joe, you know, talking to you could be a very depressing matter because I don't think that an affair between an unmarried woman and a married man always ends up as badly as you say. Sometimes the man's wife condones this sort of thing. He has a kind of hunting license.
His wife condones it?
Of course, and the last thing she wants is for him to be home attacking her every moment. She's very happy that he no longer comes to bed with her. Well, that's one kind of affair. And
well, this is
also,
not normal, though, is it?
It happens, and also an affair can sometimes lead to marriage. The man is unhappy at home. He meets somebody he's nutty about. He gets a divorce and marries the new girl, and that doesn't always end badly. So you just can't say that these things always wind up in degradation and heartache, because they just don't. And I'd probably be devastated if my husband had an affair. I don't know for sure that he isn't. Of course, I'm...
At this very moment.
At this very moment. Who knows? But I do everything I can to keep him beguiled and bemused and interested. And I think if more wives did that, I think if more wives did what girls do at the office, maybe they'd be able to compete with them a little better.
In other words, they shouldn't wear the curlers in their hair. Guy got up one morning after he was just married, and he saw his wife for the first time in curlers in her hair, and he said, what is that? She said, I just said it. He said, what time does it go off? We'll be back with Helen Gurley Brown in just a moment. One of the evils of our day is the office party. Now, you have a chapter here called The Office Party and Other Pleasures. Isn't it really true that in addition to these pleasures that you talk about, germane to an office parties sometimes result in broken careers? They sometimes involve a terrible accident that the intoxicated office worker has on his way home. Sometimes kids never see Christmas because of the Christmas office parties that end in disaster.
Joe, sometimes I think there was no Santa Claus in your life or something. You're such a prognosticator of doom, and I don't know any office parties that ever ended that way. And I did work in 19 offices. I never knew anybody to be in a terrible wreck. I never knew any homes to break up or any offices to fall apart because of office parties. I think the old-fashioned swinging office party was just one of the best parties that was ever invented, and I'm sorry they've been stamped out. But, of course, some new parties have come along to take their places. Now the parties and offices are more on team and or intimate, and they're pretty good, too. Fewer people attend them. They're less noisy, but there's more conversation, more real camaraderie and friendship, I guess.
Are you in favor, Helen Gurley Brown, of free love? I mean, can we take it that there are no morals at all to be considered?
These old-fashioned terms, Joe, you're a reasonably young man. I don't even know
they're old-fashioned, how can you remember them?
What is... I don't know what free love means. Now, what is that?
Well, do you think that people shouldn't even have to bother to get married, that they should just enjoy each other with all that that implies, sexually, uninhibitedly? There they are, stealing a few erasers, off to a matinee. This is, you know, and then they come back and have an office party. This is so fantastic. And you look at me like I'm a Puritan. You've got people who are stealing, who are committing adultery, people who are skimping on the expense account by which they cheat not only their company, but ultimately the United States government. And you look at me and you say, gee, if you don't like all this, you got to be, there's something wrong with you.
I certainly don't think that all affairs are bad and wrong. No, sometimes they enrich people's lives enormously, and I'm not going to sit here and say that no one should ever have anything to do with a man or a woman he isn't married to.
What do you mean by Chapter 5, the key to the men's room?
That's just an expression which is used when a guy has finally arrived at work. He gets the key to the men's room. He's really made it, and I say that a girl can do something comparable. She wouldn't literally get the key to the men's room, but I call that chapter by that name to indicate that she, too, can rise and have a perfectly marvelous career at the office.
What would be her reward, the key to the boss's apartment or the executive suite?
Her reward would be making a lot of money and getting a lot of recognition and being sent on business trips and getting all the prerogatives and perks that an executive man does.
Your chapter on call girls, why did you put that in this book?
Well, I think it belongs in a book called Sex in the Office because call girls are certainly a part of business offices. Many offices use these girls, and I don't think you can write a book called Sex in the Office without discussing the subject.
Well, do you believe that this is a good practice in business?
I think it's a very effective practice. I don't think it's good.
You're a terrible woman. You won't even condemn call girls.
Oh, personally, I think they have wretched lives. I go out of my way to suggest that a girl in an office who doesn't think she's getting ahead fast enough should never, never, never consider going into the call girl business because it's just too rough and too wretched, and it's not the way to do it. She can have all the things that a call girl has without doing what a call girl does as far as financial rewards are concerned. It's a whole big, wide subject.
Helen Gurley Brown, are you really a perennial single person in your mind? Do you wish that you hadn't gotten married?
No, I'm delighted to be married. I've been married 5 years. I married a dreamboat, and I'm very happy with him. However, I don't wish I'd met him any earlier. I met him when I was 36, married him when I was 37, and I did enjoy all those single girl years. And I must say I kind of identify more with single girls now than I do with wives. That's true.
Why did you marry at 36? Were you getting panicky?
No, I wasn't getting panicky. I finally met a man I thought I could be happy spending the rest of my life with, and he felt the same way about me, so we got married.
And now you share an office.
Well, I have an office at home. He doesn't share it. He has his own office.
Oh, I was hoping you could get together.
Oh, we get together.
Thank you, Helen Gurley Brown, you terrible woman. This is Joe Pyne, and we pause now for station identification. And now our guest is attorney David Keen Levitt. Mr. Levitt is a member of the Board of Governors of the Junior Bar. He's on the Adoption Committee of the Beverly Hills, California Bar Association. He received his degree in law from Stanford University and has been practicing since 1956. Mr. Levitt, why are you so disturbed about the adoption situation as we have it today in this country?
Because we have come into what I believe to be a crisis situation in the field of adoptions. There is a widespread belief among our citizens that it's hard to find a baby to adopt, whereas in truth, in the past 5 years, there has been created an alarming situation. There are thousands and thousands of children whose parents desire adoption for them. These children outnumber the adopting couples who are available. This is a nationwide problem, a shortage of adopting parents, and of course, this can be much more critical than any shortage of babies used to be in 5 or 6 years ago when people had to wait for months or even years to find a baby to adopt.
The last time I visited an orphanage, it was one run by some Polish nuns in the state of Delaware. And at that time, this must have been 10 years ago, they told me that they had no difficulty at all in placing newborn infants, but it was the children who were 5, 6, on up to 12 that were difficult to place.
That used to be the case. A few years ago, we used to hear that it was hard to place for adoption even newborn infants of a minority racial background or with some physical handicap. Today, it is hard to find adopting families for any infant, newborn, with or without handicaps, of any race and of any background. It's just hard to find adopting parents.
Well, then why is it, Mr. Levitt, that we read about people who get on a waiting list and they wait 3 to 5 years to get the baby that they want?
Several reasons. The first reason is, I think, that many of these stories are 4 or 5 years old, and in those days, 4 or 5 years ago, and before, such waiting lists were common. The second reason, I think, is that we have in some of our states, especially along the eastern seaboard, such states as New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, religious restrictions in the adoption law, which result in hundreds of thousands of children going unadopted, being raised in orphanages or foster homes, while other hundreds of thousands of families who desperately want to adopt a child must go childless.
You mean because their religions don't match up?
That's right.
Well, do you think it's a good thing for a child of one faith to be adopted by parents of another?
I think that, especially when we're dealing with newborn infants, a child has no faith. A child is a, as the old philosophers used to say, a blank sheet of paper. I think it's infinitely more important for any child to have a mother and a father and a permanent home to call his own, a family, and the love and the affection which goes to build a responsible citizen and an upright man, than it is to have any particular religion. To me, the religious problem is something which is so completely secondary as to be almost unworthy of consideration until these other factors have been taken care of.
But you can see where it would open up a group of problems. For example, if a Jewish couple were to be killed in an accident shortly after the birth of their child, their wishes could not be ignored. They deserve, at least if for no other reason than in their memory, they deserve that their child should be raised in a home that would be of a similar faith.
Absolutely, Mr. Pine, but here is where the point is. These eastern states don't care what the personal desires of the people involved are. These states don't say that you must be of a particular religion approved by the natural parent in order to adopt. These states say no matter what the parent of the child wants, the state will not permit you to adopt unless the religions match.
Well, now, on that note, how do they judge a child's religion? Is it do they judge it by the father or by the mother?
Well, this is another amusing, if it wasn't so tragic, thing. Take the question of who is Jewish, because this is what comes up most often in New York, which is where the problem is the most severe.
You mean in whether it's a race or a religion, too?
Well, no. Some groups of Jewish citizens feel, religiously, that the faith of a Jew is determined by the faith of his father. Others, there is a Jewish tradition in some parts of the world which says that a person is Jewish if his mother is Jewish. Most of the Jewish communities in New York adhere to the rule that the father determines who is Jewish. But
what,
the courts
what does
of
the
New
state
York,
say? That's what I wanted to know, yes.
The courts of New York say that only the child of a Jewish mother will be considered Jewish. A Jewish couple in New York, for instance, cannot adopt the child of a non-Jewish woman and a Jewish man.
But now, you could see where the problems could come up. For example, if a child had the characteristics of one particular religious or cultural or ethnic background, and, of course, all babies look pretty much alike, and if that child were adopted by people who had the antithesis in looks, who were perhaps as 180 degrees away in appearance, you could see where, as the years went on, parents, even foster parents, like to say, this is my baby, rather than a chosen or an adopted child, and people would look and wonder, and there would be questions, and it would lead to a certain amount sometimes of unnecessary explanations, maybe even embarrassment.
Well,
so maybe the state is wise in precluding the adopting of children of a different ethnic background.
Well, I would go along with that reasoning if experience had not shown it to be false, because where there take place 10% of all the adoptions in the United States. Here in California, we have no religious restrictions whatever in our adoption law. The only restriction recognized by the law is that the natural parent shall have the right to determine the religion of the people who shall adopt her child. And this, I think, is, of course, a proper restriction. I think a natural parent should have this right, and it should be absolute. However, in California, the bulk of adoptions, I believe, at least the bulk of private adoptions, cross the religious lines, and without any ill effects whatever. There is not a responsible authority in the entire state out of the 75 or 80,000 adoptions which have taken place in the past 15 years who has even suggested that there is the slightest unfavorable effect of the absence of religious restrictions.
Are most of our adoptable babies the products of an accident, or are they the products of an unwed mother, or what is the case in most cases?
Well, the bulk of children placed for adoption are placed by unwed mothers. But when I say the bulk of them, I mean about 40%. The majority of adoptable children, at least as I understand the latest statistics, are born to married women. About 30% of these children, or 35%, are born to married women who have had relationships with men other than their husbands.
We'll come back to you, sir, in just a moment. What kinds of people are adopting children?
All kinds of people. I would say, in general, a very fine kind of people.
How many Negro parents adopt children?
Not nearly as many as are needed.
Percentage-wise?
I can't tell you.
Would you think that they represent 20% of the all the people who adopt?
I rather doubt it.
You do? Do any of the colored parents ever adopt white children, and would you endorse that?
I would doubt that there are Negro parents adopting non-Negro children, primarily because the need for Negro parents to adopt Negro children is so overwhelming.
What about the other way around? Would you endorse a Negro child being adopted by white parents? We do read about this periodically.
I have nothing against it if the adopting parents feel that the problems created by the adoption can be successfully solved.
What do you think?
My feeling is that an adoptive situation is one which has extra problems for the adopted child and the adopting parents, over and above the problems which natural parents and children face. And of course, these problems are substantial. I think that in general, you have a better and healthier adoption when the natural, or when the adopting parents and the child have a certain physical resemblance to one another, so they do appear to be, at least conceivably, of the same family. On the other hand, there are successful interracial adoptions, and I think it's important that people who want to adopt, who feel they can have that special, that extra measure of love and of ability to take care of a child of mixed race or of Negro race, should go into this, because these youngsters who are Negroes should not be denied the right to a home and a family and loved ones simply because of the color of their skin. And
are you married, Mr. Levitt?
I certainly am.
Have you any children?
I have two.
Have you ever adopted a child?
No, I have not.
Well, with this great need that's going on right now, why haven't you?
Because I have substantial problems just keeping my own home going with the two that are in it.
Well, then how can you criticize other people for behaving the way you're behaving, for obviously the same reasons?
I'm criticizing no one. I'm simply suggesting that those people who have the extra emotional ability or emotional fullness, who would be willing to adopt across racial lines, that they not hold back and that they make themselves available to these children who so desperately need them.
Well, I didn't mean in your case across racial lines. I merely meant in as much as there is a surplus of babies, even of your own race and ethnic background, why haven't you seen fit to adopt one?
The thought has often crossed my mind. As I say, I have a substantial number of problems keeping my home functioning with the two.
But what are the problems that beset a family? Say a family like yours with two children that have been born to you, is it better to bring a child into a no-child family or into a family such as yours?
Well, I think it's probably best to bring a child into a home where there are other children.
See, we keep coming back to you, Mr. Levitt. I think we better get you down to the adoption agency as quickly as possible.
Well, I would suggest this, that if I were an adopting parent rather than a natural parent, I would feel no different about adopting a third child than I feel at this point about adopting a first child.
In your experience, well, now, in your experience, what is the basic difference in being the father of an adopted child or the father of a naturally born child? Having dealt with these individuals, what do you find is the basic difference? You can answer that right after this word. Yes, have your clients from time to time expressed any feelings in this regard?
Well, my clients have, and also I'm associated with the Adopted Children's Association of Los Angeles, which is a perfectly splendid group of adopting parents who have adopted both from agencies and independently. This group is about 15 years old, has over 1,000 members, and they speak rather freely about the problems of adoption, and I have yet to hear from one of them, and a number of the members have both adopted and natural children, that there's the slightest difference in their attitudes.
Now, welfare officials throughout the United States, Mr. Levitt, have been claiming that attorneys and physicians have been selling babies or engaged in the black marketing of babies. What about that?
Well, I think that certainly there has been no evidence of this in California.
Well, now, in your own state, the California State Department of Social Welfare states that more than 2,000 of the 4,000 independent adoptions in the state each year are illegal.
This was a statement which was made by Mrs. Kuplin, who was the chief of adoptions of the State Department of Social Welfare. This was back in 1961. I have here with me an article from the San Francisco News Call Bulletin of June 17, 1964, where Mrs. Kuplin is quoted as saying that there is no black market in California, and setting forth some of the problems which exist in the state about the oversupply of adoptable children here. You can't have a black market where the supply exceeds the demand in anything.
Well, what about Senator Dodd's views on not permitting adoption placements by anyone but licensed agencies?
Well, Senator Dodd's views, I believe, are based upon an out-of-date appreciation of what the facts are. Senator Dodd, I might add, comes from the only state in the union, Connecticut, which absolutely forbids adoptions except through agencies. In other words, they have an adoption agency monopoly in Connecticut. No other state has seen fit to copy it.
Well, don't you think that Senator Dodd has a good point of view here, because at least we know that little human beings won't be handed back and forth among unscrupulous attorneys and physicians for money?
The right solution is to do something about these religious laws in the eastern states. If it were not for the religious restrictions in the New York adoption law, there wouldn't be 3/4 of the interstate adoptions in the United States today.
Well, sir, why this great desire to get people adopted anyway? You know, some of the finest, most well-balanced individuals I've ever known have been products of orphanages.
I don't think you know so many of the products of orphanages, though, that did not turn out to be the most well-balanced people you know. The products of our foster homes, of our broken homes, broken families, fatherless homes, constitute 70% of the population of juvenile hall here, for instance. They constitute a like percentage of the population of our prisons. It's never been a bonus of any kind to any human being to be raised in an institution or in a foster home.
Well, I imagine what you've said would certainly be authentic when you apply it to a child who has survived a broken home and then gone on to an orphanage, but I'm talking about a child who's never known anything but the orphanage.
Well, they have, of course, in New York, again, they have a terrible problem with Negro children because they have no one who will adopt them. And these Negro children are put in nurseries from birth, and there is just no one to take them. What happens to them? After a few months, they wither. They just shrivel up. They become emotionally blunt. What happens to these children? They become mentally retarded. They wouldn't be mentally retarded if they had a mother and father to love them, but they have nobody except nursery nurses.
We'll be back to you, Mr. Levitt, in just a moment. Now, Mr. Levitt, what do you foresee here for the future? Some kind of a national educational and advertising program whereby the American people, who have always opened up their hearts to any emergency, can become cognizant of this problem?
I think this is absolutely essential. I think, first of all, the shortage of adopting parents, the enormous flood of babies who need adoption, has got to be brought to the attention of the people. I think every time I hear of a couple that goes overseas to find a baby to bring back here, I wonder if that couple knows how many children there are right on their front doorstep who need them desperately.
Is that done quite often, by the way, this going overseas?
Oh, absolutely. I think many of the American people believe the only place you can adopt is overseas.
In other words, they've been driven overseas because they felt that they didn't want to wait 2 to 5 years.
Well, very often they don't know what the facts are. They didn't investigate. They just assumed they had to wait 5 years.
Well, what are the facts? How can a person in a typical U.S. town get a child? How long will it take to get one?
Well, I would suggest that what you do is you talk to a local attorney who you determine has some experience concerning adoptions. At the same time, you should talk to a local adoption agency and find out what their situation is. If you live in a state like California, the Los Angeles County Bureau of Adoptions, in the ordinary case, dealing with a reasonably qualified couple, and their standards are not outrageous at all, will have a baby in your home within 4 months. In other Western states or states with liberal adoption laws, you can adopt through an agency in a very few months. Independently, it can take only weeks. In states like New York or Massachusetts or Connecticut, you have a real problem if your religion isn't right. But I think there the solution is to liberalize these laws and get these children out of the foster homes and out of the orphanages and into families.
All right. In other words, within 4 months, it's a typical example, within 4 months one can have a child.
In the Los Angeles County Bureau of Adoptions, you can.
Mm-hmm. And where the state doesn't make any religious problems, probably that would be a fair guess of time for most of the country.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Levitt, we want to thank you for being here and telling us something about the adoption problem, and we're happy to hear you say that there's no black market in babies. We don't know that you're right, but we're happy to hear you say it, and we hope you are right. This is Joe Pine. Thank you for listening, and straight ahead.